James Steele and Rob Willis here with some more Yarns of Oz. This time we're talking about urban legends, memes, factoids and conspiracy theories. All true, of course.
Of course. This goes back a long way with you, doesn't it, Graham?
Yeah, I've been looking at these urban legends and myths and memes for many years now, and I haven't done much on in recent years, but back, I suppose, in the 90s, particularly in the early 2000s, yes, I put out a couple of books of them and collected an awful lot of them and heard an awful lot of them. I guess since then, at that stage, most of them were still being transmitted orally, you know, parties at work or wherever, for people telling each other these tales. But I think since the internet or the World Wide Web in particular has become so ever all present, omnipresent.
That's the word.
Yeah, it means that they've kind of amplified, really, and they've kind of just gone into that morass of fake news, misinformation, and memes that float around or everywhere now, just about. I mean, you can't escape it, can you, if you're anywhere connected to the Digiverse?
Yeah. Well, I think that's the first time that I'd ever heard of Graham Searle when I received your book, Great Australian Urban Myths, Granny on the Roof Rack. And I'm just looking at the date of publication here, about 1995 or something. So
that's right, yeah. That was my first shot at it. That was a fairly thin one. And the next 5 years I spent sort of getting a lot more. And there was a new edition came out in 2001 with an awful lot more in it. That's right. And I still was only, you know, scraping the surface, really.
So what is an urban myth or an urban legend?
That's right. We've got everybody on the hook now, hopefully.
Well, we have.
Yes. Well, they're sometimes called friend of a friend stories by folklorists, which means that they're tales told as true tales, allegedly heard from a friend of a friend or your second cousin's aunt or somebody down the street last week. So they're very vague, but they're told as true. People believe in them, or at least say they believe them to be true. They're a story, something happens. There is an outcome, there are people involved. They often contain some kind of moral or warning. Often there's a yuck factor to them. And I suppose a good example would be the Bali spiders, which is an Australian version of a widespread urban legend. And the story in the Australian version is that there's a young woman sunning herself on the beach in Bali on her holidays, and she feels a slight nip on her cheek as she's lying there, and she pushes it away, and she doesn't know what it is. Must have been a mozzie bite or something. Thinks no more about it. Back to the hotel, packs up, takes off the next morning back to Sydney on the flight. She gets on the plane, that this bite on her cheek has kind of grown into a bit of a boil. It's not too good at all. And as she, by the time she gets back to Sydney, it's even got even bigger. So very concerned, off she goes to the doctor. And the doctor says, goodness me, I'll have to lance that, which he does. And of course, as he does, dozens of little spiders crawl out all over her face. So that was...
it's a yuck factor.
Yeah, there's a yuck factor for you. There's the warning factor, of course, about be careful in foreign places. And there's the... I guess, yeah, there's just the general entertainment factor as well, I suppose, of a story. And I've heard that story many times in many guises. It doesn't always happen in Bali. It can be somewhere else, exotic, you know, Phuket or wherever. And as I said, it's told all over the world as well. But it's just a good example, I guess, of a typical urban legend, or urban myths, they're often called popularly.
Yeah, I must admit that when I was but a callow youth, that I heard a few of these and genuinely believed them and passed them on. I think the one that I can think of is the fellow who had a convertible car and he was playing up with the wife of a concrete man who drove one of those big concrete trucks. And anyway, the whole thing turned up and was found out, and the man with the convertible ended up with a convertible full of concrete, which set. And
yes,
of course, that was it. Yeah. And that was true.
Absolutely. It's an old favourite. Yeah, indeed. And that one's told all around the world too. Excuse me, what was. And yeah, it's the revenge factor there, of course, is very high. And if only the villains could be so served in real life, wouldn't it be great? Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. So yeah, there's as I said, there's many of these stories. They often have a point of sorts. They're told as true, and they're very believable. until you actually start trying perhaps to sort of tease them apart a little bit. I mean, if you tease the Bali spiders one apart a bit, it's not really logical, is it, when you think about it? First of all, that there would be anything that large on someone's face that would have that many spiders in it, or within a day or two that the spiders, which were presumably in egg form, had been matured to the point where they were little baby spiders crawling over the lady's face in the doctor's surgery.
Makes you wonder where these things originate from, whether someone just, it's a figment of someone's imagination, or they thought, oh, wow, that's a good story, we'll make it true.
Yeah.
Or it becomes true.
Where there's smoke, there's fire, as they say in the folk proverbs, but generally speaking, when people have tried to track these things to some kind of origin, and quite a lot of people have over the years, they come up with nothing. Some stories have a basis. In fact, stories about the missing kidney legend, which was quite popular. Some guy was out for the night on the town, got drunk, woke up somewhere in a bath in a hotel, feeling a bit of a pain in his side, and realised that someone had ripped out his kidney while he was drunk or drugged. And the justification behind that was that he'd been a victim of the international organ trade. Well, we didn't know very much about the organ trade in those days. However, since then, we do know there is definitely an international trade in illegally harvested organs. Not like that, hopefully, but nevertheless, there is a trade there. So even though the legend itself is no doubt an exaggeration and mythical, nevertheless, the situation does exist, and it's probably that which gives rise to, the rise of the legend, and then perhaps its proliferation as well.
So how far do these go back? Are they something that you've found in your research that go way, way back through this friend of a friend sort of thing? Or is it only a recent occurrence?
Folklorists started noticing them in about the 1950s, and they gave them the name urban legends, or more accurately, contemporary legends. Because they happen in rural locations as well. There are people in the bush as well, aren't there? As well as in cities.
There are.
Yeah. So they called them that, and then they started investigating them, and more were found around the world. And, of course, then we also started looking into their origins a bit, and quite a lot of the themes of urban legends are, in fact, quite old, going back to earlier times, you know, the kind of concerns about visitations from above in the medieval era, that kind of thing, stories of supernatural happenings and so forth. So, yeah, they appear to be a classic folklore. It's old wine in new bottles is another one of those sort of handy little sayings you can use to describe folklore, I suppose. You know, we just keep recirculating it in a new form, but it goes to the same kind of basic human issues and concerns that we all share.
So it's not the sort of thing you find in old newspapers, pre-1950s type of thing?
Good question. A lot of them did get transmitted through newspapers. In my experience of it, probably not until about the 60s. And journalists used to pick them up all the time and often just tell them, not always tongue-in-cheek, but they'd be in columns. The Column 8 in the Sydney Morning Herald, I think, was a great place for urban legends for many years. And most newspapers have got one or two or 3 million dozen of them, often just given as factual without anybody ever having checked, which of course brings us to our current situation with fake news, misinformation and so forth as well.
Yeah, I think I saw the, the pelican who picks up the chihuahua or something. That's one that I read in a paper somewhere.
Lovely
one. Wow, yeah.
Or sometimes it's the baby. Depending on the version, but yeah, and someone's camping and the chihuahua's there and the pelican comes along and zips it up and disappears into nowhere with it.
So it's been, as you say, the transmission as someone over the back fence or something, oh look, a friend of a friend told me about this and it's true, leaning forward and saying yes, it's true.
Yes, that's right. People say they believe it. This is another one of the intriguing things about these stories, I think. As I said, if you do actually sit down a bit and tease them out and think about them, generally speaking, they don't hold up terribly well. Never mind what source it came from, because you can't track that down either. The friend of a friend is long gone, if there ever was one. But people do say they believe them. And as I said, I have actually interviewed people who, you know, fervently believe in the truth of quite authoritatively debunked urban legends. But yeah, there you go.
And you mentioned that they have changed, and I suppose with social media, when you're talking in the 1950s, it was really over the back fence, but now it's probably on platforms such as Facebook or something like that, that this amazing spread would happen.
I think so, yeah, that the internet just amplifies everything. It amplifies error, and it transmits it immediately, of course, from place to place. I mean, oral transmission in the old days, if you like, before the internet, was pretty effective. Remember all those sick jokes and things that used to come around? You know, they were told in America and 8 hours later or something, they'd be in Europe because people would get on a plane and go and tell their mate when they arrived in Paris or whatever it was. Today, it's just completely instantaneous. It's also around the world, everywhere. And in those days, of course, most individuals only had one or two social networks. Today, if you're on the internet, you have unlimited social networks, effectively, whether you partake in them or not. The minute you put it up there, well, off it's gone around the world.
The story just becomes insert country here or insert location here or something.
That's exactly right. I don't even bother with that now, I don't think much. People just sort of chuck it up on their Facebook page and, you know, someone says, oh, that's good, send it off to my show, I'll share it with my network. And, you know, it's all there and you're just completely overwhelmed with it all the time. So people don't have the opportunity to tease out whether or not it's true or false. It's just more of this continual war flowering of nonsense.
Which raises something with me. Both you and I were avid collectors of fax lore when fax first came out. Yeah. And I think I have reams of it as you. Yep. The only trouble with that, it tends to fade very, very quickly on the fax paper.
Yep.
Was this the first sort of universal way of getting these myths and legends out as far to a wider audience?
I think so. To some extent, the fax law, photocopy law, which we're talking about, is sort of starts around about the 1940s with the invention of the photocopier, and people start knocking out these stories and little cartoons, of course. The Last Great Act of Defiance, which shows some little bird, a little mouse sort of putting its finger up towards a giant hawk that's just about to eat it, those sort of things. And a lot of them are visual, because you had the opportunity, because the photocopier gave you the opportunity for a visual format, which wasn't available, generally speaking, before that. But, and again, in some ways, it was a precursor of the internet, because you could make infinite number of copies and you could send them around, if only by hand or by mail, to your mates. And later on, of course, then, of course, the faxes arrived and you could send them through the fax system as well. Again, another precursor of the internet. But some urban legends, well, in fact, quite a few urban legends were included in fax lore, but most of it, I think, was probably visual. Yeah, and I've got both, as you probably have in your collection as well. But
Now, you've got that some of these urban legends, they tend to originate in situations of stress and other fault lines of human relations. Is the military carrying forward these stories? Were there very many in the military? Because, I mean, you can't get much more stress than that.
Well, I've never looked at military legends. It'd be an interesting study, actually, yeah. Might be a bit late now, I suppose, but yeah, I don't know. Don't know the answer to that one.
So there's no particular genre or anything. It's just whatever happens to come along.
They tend to be about social fears, concerns of things about drugs, for example, pedophiles, serial killers, foreigners, as the example we gave there. A good example, I guess, is the COVID situation we're in now. Excuse me. Back in the late 19th century, there was a typhoid outbreak in America, and a woman who was known as Typhoid Mary was said to be going around spreading the disease, which she actually was. She didn't know it. She was a super spreader, and she didn't, but was asymptomatic. So those sort of legends grew from there. In the AIDS epidemic of the 80s, there was AIDS Mary, or sometimes it was a man, AIDS Harry or something. Again, a person who was said to be going around deliberately spreading the disease. And in the COVID era, of course, we've had as a COVID Mary. Fairly early on, I found one in Korea, which was one of the early countries there. And according to the local law there, this woman was deliberately going through the community and infecting everybody. Never found, of course. No basis for it, but the story circulated. So it was just another example of that kind of shared social concern. Obviously, a pandemic qualifies as one of those. And again, the rebirth, if you like, of an old story.
And that fear factor that comes into it.
And the fear, yes. And I think it comes back to, why do we tell these things then? So yeah, I think it's a trouble shared is a trouble halved. I'm feeling very proverbial today for some reason. And it's the sharing of the concern. It isn't so much an issue of whether it's true or false. It's a matter that you have shared some kind of narrative about the issue. And it's kind of a little bit of a social safety valve, I think, in many ways. And also a little bit of a consolation, because at least, you know, someone else knows about this issue as well that might have been bothering you. You've read about it in the papers or whatever it might be. And it is consoling to some extent to know that others also share that concern. Or if they didn't before, they do now because you just told them.
And of course, sex cops a fair sort of a go as well, doesn't it?
Sex is a goodie. That's right. Yeah, the white slave trade stories. You know, kids being kidnapped from the toilets and things in local supermarkets. Naked babysitters. The naked caravaner. I think the naked caravan is a good one. Yes. You know that
That's
one, don't
true.
You?
I yeah, heard yeah, that. Graham,
you tell it. You tell that one, Rob.
Well, I can only tell you the Central West version of New South Wales.
That's
that I heard
good.
Again, which was told to me by a friend of a friend, or a friend of a friend actually. It was there. this fella and his wife were on a caravan trip, and she decided she would stay in the back of the caravan, like stay in the caravan and have a sleep while they were travelling. And anyway, they stopped, and she got out and had to go and do what you do by the side of the road, and hubby took off. And this biker comes along, and she's naked, of course, which is the most important part. And so the biker says, well, look, you know, we can catch up to your husband, hop on the back, and away we go. So a couple of miles down the track, and the hubby's driving along. Next thing he sees this motorbike going past with a naked wife on the pillion passenger side, waving at him. And of course, he goes off into the scrub and gets killed.
Yep, that's it.
That's one version,
yep,
but it was true.
Right. Yeah, yeah. No, that's right. That's like a bit like the one on the exploding dunny, which again is an old one, but in its sort of urban legend version, the wife cleans the toilet with some kind of chemical aerosol. Hubby goes in to have a poo, and of course has a smoke. Drops his durry in the bowl, which of course immediately explodes, destroying the toilet and putting the hubby in rather a bad way with, in his rear end. The ambulance is called, of course, they're taking him to hospital, and the ambulance drivers come and put the man on the stretcher, and as they're taking him out, the guy says to the injured man, well, what's happened? And the guy tells him what's happened, and the ambulance driver laughs so much they drop him and he breaks his leg.
Oh, there's a double barrel one.
A double barrel one, yeah.
Yeah, there isn't it. That's interesting, because I heard that as a true story again, the exploding dunny, and it happened at Mount Panorama while the car races were on.
Of course, yeah.
Of course, yeah. And excrement everywhere.
Right. Well, more excrement everywhere. Sorry.
That was a secondary one, yeah. But I had not heard about the ambulance.
That's a little modern twist to it, I think. You know, it's just that little bubble, isn't it? Yeah, it's the twist at the tail. Yeah.
But it's all true.
Oh, yes. Mm. Absolutely.
So you've got lots of topics here that you've covered as well. You've got horrors, which we talked about with spiders, penetrations.
Yes. Oh, yes, penetrations and contaminations, of course, stories about foreign objects in takeaway food. The dogs in the Chinese restaurant menu, you know, of course, that old one. Kentucky Fried Rat was one I remember. Hold the Mayo was a particularly gross one about some people in hamburger joints putting the mayonnaise on, and if they didn't like the customer, they masturbated onto the patty instead. Things like that. So pretty yucky, and a bit worrying, because you don't really know what's going on behind the scenes there in the kitchen, do you? You know, and if someone's taken a dislike to you, perhaps always, you know, villainously minded, you know, we don't really know. So
well,
careful that's, next that's time you get a burger.
Yeah, that's a way of bringing down a business, isn't it?
Indeed. That's another thing too. Yeah, commercial rumours, yeah. Satanic signs in logos. I forget, Procter & Gamble, I think it was, in America, had a very strange logo they'd had for hundreds of years or something, of seven stars, I think it was. And the rumour went around that was a satanic symbol, and that Procter & Gamble were, you know, in league with the devil. Yeah, very unlikely, but nevertheless, many people believe this, to the extent that eventually it became a problem for them in selling their product, and they had to change their logo. That was probably back in the 90s, I think, from memory. I'd have to track it all down again to get the details, but I think it's actually in one of my books. But they can have consequences in real life as well.
Yeah, and playing records backwards or something, you'd get a satanic...
That's
The Beatles, I think,
that's
as well,
right.
as I can't remember.
Yeah, reverse masking was. It was a satanic message, I think. Can't remember which Beatles record it was. But someone out there will remember, you can be sure of that.
Of course they let us know, for goodness sake, yeah. You mentioned the relationship to conspiracy theories and fake news and that sort of genre that's happening now.
Yeah. Well, I think that's, as I said, I think urban legends have just morphed into that great amorphous mass of disinformation and fake news that we're all faced with. And again, it works the same way. If we're told something by somebody we know or think we know face to face, which is what happened with urban legends originally, but now we're told on the internet, which is for many people a very close substitute for face to face. In fact, for many people it's become face to face. Even though it's a very different kind of medium of communication. But all those things about the credibility of oral communication have just amplified, I think, on the internet, and make these sorts of things much more possible for all the reasons I said. They're immediate, they spread quickly, and they are, to some people at least, believable, and people are apparently prepared to believe, you know, that there is a QAnon conspiracy of some mysterious person called Q who's fighting against some dreadful conspiracy of pedophiles and whatever else it is in America. And Donald Trump was, part of his job while he was president was to sort this out. Complete and utter crap. But nevertheless, it seems that 70 million people believe that kind of shit because they voted for Donald Trump. And quite a few thousand of them turned up at the Capitol in an insurrection based upon... such absolutely incredible and uncredible nonsense. So it's serious stuff now, I think.
Is there any way of busting these urban legends?
A lot of people have tried. I was reading some stuff recently, actually, about psychologists who've had various sorts of attempts to do it. They haven't been very successful. You can debunk and you can... reason and rationalise with people as much as you like, but once they've bought a particular belief, they're going to hang on to it, even though they're told reliably and credibly that, you know, it's not a goer. So it doesn't seem that that's the case. There are a few things you can do. One of my books, I had a little urban legend detection kit, which had seven or eight little steps that you could take yourself to do it, but I can't see very many people taking the time and trouble to do that. Unless they were seriously concerned about something that they'd heard or seen, on the internet or face-to-face. So at this stage, it appears that despite a lot of effort by a lot of people and a lot of places to find ways to debunk this kind of thing and to short-circuit it, defuse it, no is the answer. Short answer, I think, no. And that's very worrying, as I said, because as we've seen, the consequences can be extremely worrying in the real life.
Yes, before it seems to me that it was a true story as told by a friend of a friend. Now it is getting that element of danger and can be quite quite disastrous.
Yeah, people are prepared to act upon those beliefs. and do something like join a far right organisation or turn up on the steps of the Capitol and, you know, call for the blood of the Speaker or whatever it is, it was. So, yeah, I mean, this is very, very serious, I think. And a lot of other people do too.
Yeah. So as with most other elements of folklore, these will continue, but this particular aspect could be a little bit dangerous.
I think so, yeah. As I said, it's something that's going to be with us for a long time, I think. And we're going to struggle to find ways to deal with it, unfortunately. You've been listening to another episode in the Yarns of Oz series with Rob Willis and Graham Steele. And remember, unless you heard it here, don't believe a thing you hear. See you later.